This is the session, just to be very clear that you're in the right place, on cultural autonomy versus self-determination, debates on the national question in the Second International. You're all in the right place? Good. And you're giving the right talk, Mick?
Maybe.
Maybe something.
Yeah, well, that's up to you lot to assess. Yeah.
So, if you want to switch to Mick to... No, not really. Yeah. That's what he's doing. So our speaker is Mick Armstrong, who's obviously a founder member of Socialist Alternative from Melbourne. He'll be giving the talk, and then we'll have a discussion after that. So, Mick, take it away.
Okay. Well, there's... Debates in the Second International about the national question can seem like a very esoteric and historical debate. And at one level it is. However, the national question in its innumerable forms today, whether it be Palestine, Catalonia, West Papua, Ireland, Sri Lanka, remains a central issue in world politics, and it's not going away. It is far from being the case, as the likes of Tony Negri once argued, that globalised capitalism is making nation-states or nationalism irrelevant. And I would argue that the debates in the Second International can provide important insights in how Marxists should respond to the national questions today in the various forms that comes up. But it's also relevant to the discussions about issues to do with multiculturalism in countries like Australia. From the outset, I will make my biases clear. I believe that Lenin's position on the national question was far superior to the other socialist theorists of the day, whether it be the Austro-Marxists, people like Bauer, the Bund, Kautsky, Rosa Luxemburg, Stalin or Bukharin. And that is not because Lenin had a better understanding at an abstract level of the basis of nationalism, but because, in my view, Lenin, as on other questions, approached the issue in a profoundly political way, i.e. in terms of what the national question and how to relate to it meant for the working class movement and the struggle for socialism. Lenin's focus was on developing a socialist policy that could help to cohere the working class across national lines to help overthrow capitalism. And that led him to an understanding of the vital importance for socialists of combating the national chauvinism of oppressor nations such as the Great Russians and supporting national self-determination for oppressed nations. And by national self-determination we mean the right to secede and set up their own state. This also led Lenin to draw an important distinction between the nationalism of an oppressed people and the nationalism of an oppressor people. And furthermore, and particularly in the Comintern years, as Lenin further developed his understanding of the national question, it led him to see the vital role that national liberation struggles in the colonial world could play in weakening imperialism and enhancing the struggles of workers in the imperialist heartlands. Okay, but to start with the obvious question, what is a nation? And we have to say this is an incredibly fraught question. There is no simple definition, and in my mind, to search for some sort of clear criteria for deciding what is or isn't a nation is a rabbit warren that is not worth going down. Stalin and various others attempted to draw up objective criteria for determining what isn't and is a nation. Did the people have their own language, their own common territory, their own culture, and so on? It was a checklist approach. Tick enough boxes and you're qualified as being a nation. There's a common myth that Lenin supervised and approved Stalin's work on the national question in the pamphlet he wrote. The reality is that Lenin was far from adhering to Stalin's abstract criteria for defining a nation. And as soon as you start to look at the already existing nations in the world today, the checklist approach starts to break down badly. Take one criterion, a common language. Well, Switzerland is one of the oldest nations in the world.
And yet, there's no common language. The Swiss speak German, French, and Italian. There's no common language in India or Papua New Guinea and in numerous other relatively recent nation states. And even in some of the older nations, such as France, which do have a common language, that is a relatively recent phenomenon. It was only in the process of actually forming the nation that a common language was brought about by the oppression of other nationalities and the forceful imposition in France of the French language. Prior to the French Revolution, French was a minority language in France. Now, a whole variety of other languages were spoken, whether it was Basque, Provençal, Corsican, Alsatian, Celtic, Flemish, and so on. But even the forceful imposition of a common language is not enough to establish a common nationality. Take the case of the Irish, who by the end of the 19th century overwhelmingly spoke English, yet, despite that common language, maintained a separate nationality from their British impressors. The next standard criterion is a common territory. Well, Alaska has no common border with the rest of the United States. Hawaii is thousands of kilometres from the west coast of the US, and yet they form part of one nation. Pakistan had no common territory when it was first formed. Indonesia has no real common territory. It is all just a series of aggregated islands. The only thing they had in common was that they were subject to Dutch imperialism. And you can go through country after country is similar. Territorial boundaries in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, and so on, were commonly lines on maps drawn for the convenience of the colonial overlords. You know, the French carved Syria, you know, and separated Lebanon from it. Pakistan was, was divided out of India by the British. Sudan and South Sudan were artificially created by the British. The final criteria usually held up is culture. And this is an incredibly vague criterion. The idea that the world's people are divided up into all these discrete cultures is pretty ludicrous. The most obvious case is, what are these profound cultural differences that have separated Australians from New Zealanders? National cultures are overwhelmingly recent inventions, and culture today is increasingly cosmopolitan and Americanized thanks to Hollywood and so on. And 100 years ago, let alone 200 years ago, the overwhelming majority of the people on this planet were peasants. And by and large, the peasantry had little or no national traditions or national consciousness. In terms of lifestyles, there was little to separate the peasantry of what today is Indonesia or Java from the peasantry of the Malay Peninsula or of the Philippines. And similarly, today, supermarket workers in Italy or France or Germany have much more in common culturally than the owners of the supermarket stores. The symbols chosen to identify people are contextually determined and quite arbitrary. Often though imposed upon a subjugated people by the imperial power. For example, the Muslim and Hindu identities in India were overwhelmingly established by the British. And if you went into, the 18th century into an Indian village, people did not make these distinctions at all. They were created by the imperial power to divide and rule. And if an imperial order insisted that the subordinate class was black or Buddhist or Bantu speaking, these became the basis for a defensive nationalist reaction. Anti-colonial struggles forged nations from highly heterogeneous populations made up of a whole different tribal groupings, class groupings, language groupings, religious groupings, and caste groupings. and identities emerge extremely rapidly. In some cases, in the basis of 6 or 18 months, a new national identity could emerge. Middle-class intellectuals amongst the oppressed colonial people played decisive roles in developing a nationalist myth to forge a national identity where none previously had existed. The fact that the basic concepts which define and sustain the existence of a nation were commonly forced upon a subordinate people shows the error in attempting to define nations by some sort of checklist of objective criteria, as did both Stalin and, to a different way, the Austro-Marxist Otto Bauer. There are no grounds for denying that a people do constitute a nation, if they insist they are. However, the concepts are specific to a very discrete context. There is no basis for us trying to establish some science of nationalism. And I think Leon Trotsky summed it up well when he stated, an abstract criterion is not decisive in the question. Far more decisive is the historical consciousness of a group, their feelings, their impulses. But that too is not determined accidentally, but rather by the situation and all the attendant circumstances. Okay, now, to move on to specifically deal with the question of the Austro-Marxists. Otto Bauer was a leading intellectual on the left wing of the Austrian Social Democratic Party, and he published his major work on the national question, which was titled The Questions of Nations and Social Democracy, in 1907. He was writing in a society which was racked by national tensions, and Austria-Hungary was a very peculiar beast, a multinational empire presided over by a dual monarchy. One half of the monarchy, Hungarians, were the dominant national group. In the other half, the Austrian half, where the Austro-Marxists were based, Germans were the dominant national group. And there was considerable opposition to this German domination by the oppressed national groupings, whether they be Czechs, Poles, Ukrainians, Slovenes, Italians, and so on. And these tensions were reflected inside the Social Democratic Party of Austria itself. It was a party which grew very rapidly and was proportionately significantly bigger than the German Social Democratic Party. And particularly was strong in Vienna, which grew rapidly from about a population of about 500,000 in 1864 to 2 million on the eve of the First World War. And to give you a feel of the strength of the Austrian Social Democrats, 200,000 people marched in their May Day contingent in Vienna as early as 1890. For many years, the party leadership, headed by Viktor Adler, resisted debate on the national question, fearing a split. And Adler decisively underestimated the underlying socioeconomic basis and the political reasons for national conflict. Adler agreed with Karl Kautsky that the national question could be reduced to a language problem and therefore transferred from the economic and political sphere onto the cultural terrain. There was a profound lack of theoretical clarity in the party on the national question, and the formal positions they adopted jumped around pragmatically from party congress to party congress. One of the earliest congresses in 1874 had voted for the right of national self-determination, but this was soon dropped. A majority of the Czech Social Democrats, which came from the most politically advanced and most proletarian of the Slavic groups, pushed for autonomy within the party. And when Viktor Adler resisted that push, they split away to form a separate Czech party in 1893. And this Czech breakaway sent a signal to the other oppressed national groups. And in the aftermath of it, the party began to make serious concessions to nationalism. And at the 1897 Vienna Congress, the party resolved to make itself into a federation of six national groupings. Eventually, the Czechs went on to form not just their own separate party, but their own separate Czech-speaking trade unions, including in areas of mixed population. So you started to have the situation where you had Czech-speaking and German-speaking unions, both supposedly headed by Marxists, competing against each other and that. And this entrenched national divisions in the working class. At the 1899 Bern Congress, the German section of the party argued for more centralisation in order to better fight the empire, whereas the Southern Slavs argued instead for, quote, personal cultural autonomy. That is, that inhabitants of the empire should be grouped according to culture, regardless of where they lived, and their cultural and educational activities directed by an elected national council. The pragmatic compromise adopted at the Congress, however, was for a federation of self-governing territories defined by nationality, with the scattered territories of each nationality to be united in a national council with complete authority in the affairs of that nationality, which were defined as cultural and linguistic. Economic and political matters would remain at the hands of the national government. The right of national self-determination, then, was sacrificed to preserve the unity of the empire and the inviolability of the borders of the monarchy. The Austro-Marxists were for transforming the empire into a bourgeois democratic multinational state, using the national minorities and the revolts by them to stage an insurrection to overthrow the ruling classes of the Austrian Empire was totally ruled out. They argued for a two-stage revolution, first a political revolution and then gradually an economic and social revolution. And this was reflected as early as 1876, when the slogan adopted by the party was, "The workers of Austria fight, but they do so within the framework of the existing constitution." i.e. they accepted the monarchy and the fight and fought for improvements within it. This compromise approach was the worst of both possible worlds. On the one hand, there were concessions and compromises to nationalism, which led to the dividing of the party into separate national federations, which only served to increase national frictions inside the party itself and in the broader working class movement. And after the 1907 elections, the national components of the party increasingly operated as separate parties. On the other hand, while making concessions to the nationalism of the various national groupings, they refused to grant the basic democratic right of national self-determination. And of all of this was proved to be for naught, because with the First World War, the whole empire was blown apart and led to the creation of a whole series of new nation states. Now, Bauer's book, The Question of Nationalities and Social Democracy, was an attempt to give the pragmatically involving policy of the party in the national question some theoretical coherence and substance. Bauer, as I said, came from the left wing of the party, and his concern was how to create a unified working class movement but within the borders of the existing imperial state. In that regard, Bauer's approach was not that radically different from Karl Renner, who was the leading theoretician on the national question of the right wing of the party. Renner saw nations as the fundamental building blocks of society, in his words, both indestructible and undeserving of destruction. Nations, in Renner's views, would not dissolve under socialism. Renner argued that multinational states such as Austria-Hungary were necessary because of economic development. Consequently, nationality could no longer be a state-forming principle. Renner was for separating the supposed essence of nationalism, culture and language, from the organisation of economic activity and embodying, you know, that essence of nationalism in separate institutions. Similarly, Bauer himself saw nations not as some recent development created by the bourgeoisie, but a residue of historic peoples. To quote him, the nations were the totality of men bound together through a common destiny in a common community. According to Bauer, individuals form a nation through a unified will. Bauer polemicised against those like Kalkowski, who argued that a nation was defined by common language and territory. Bauer correctly observed that there existed not only distinct nations that spoke a common language, but also conquered nations that preserved their distinct nationality while adopting the language of the invader. In Bauer's analysis, in his analysis of individual factors that make up a nationality, such as economic conditions, political organisation and culture, Bauer put culture first. According to Bauer, quote, "The nation is the totality of human beings being bound together by a community of fate into a community of character." Reflecting this analysis, Bauer foresaw personal cultural autonomy. He made a sharp distinction between the economic and the cultural, and denied the right to national self-determination. However, there is little validity in the distinction Bauer drew between economics and culture when it comes to nationalism. Nationalist movements have rarely confined themselves to the cultural arena. Overwhelmingly, nationalist movements have pursued not culture, but political power. And above all, the power of the state, which once won, supposedly would then protect, you know, the glories of the national culture. Bauer believed that class antagonisms and social contradictions would be reduced when a nation matures and would be entirely abolished under socialism, when broad social layers were able to participate in national culture. For Bauer, the problem for the working class and the peasantry was that they were excluded from national cultural life, which was dominated by the ruling class and the educated middle class. Bauer wrote, "Only the rule of the working class would create the conditions for a nation in the full sense of the term, as it would strengthen the development towards an intellectually unified civilization. The international struggle is a means we must use to realise our national ideal." But of course, it is far from being the case, as history has proved since Bauer's time, that class divisions and social contradictions have disappeared in the most advanced capitalist countries. In reality, they have been further entrenched, and nationalism has become an even more powerful and reactionary force. Bauer and the other leading Austro-Marxists saw preserving a large state as beneficial to all. They did not make a sharp distinction between the nationalism of oppressed nations and oppressor nations, and they did not recognise the progressive element of national liberation struggles. Workers' struggles in their respective countries were understood by the Austro-Marxists not as attempts to seize political power, but as struggles against the national bourgeoisie for access to the cultural sphere. Both Bauer and Renner thought a democratic bourgeois parliament would resolve the national question. They saw national consciousness as in essence apolitical, as cultural and educational, and not state-oriented. And consequently, there was the separation of state and nation. There was, however, an element of German nationalism in Bauer's position, which was also reflected in the rest of the party leadership. Although Bauer, who was himself Jewish, was critical of the strong anti-Semitic strain in German nationalism, he was fascinated by German culture. He saw German culture and nationalism overall as positive and was concerned to preserve the German nation. In particular, he was concerned that the various isolated German-speaking peoples would be absorbed into surrounding Slavic populations. At the outbreak of World War I, Bauer, like the vast majority of the Austro-Marxists, supported the German-Austrian alliance in the war with Russia. He did not join the anti-war left wing of the party headed by Friedrich Adler. And at the end of the war, Bauer supported unity between Austria and Germany. In the case of Karl Renner, the other leading Austro-Marxist theorist on the national question, the situation was even clearer and worse. During World War I, Renner argued that the German-Austrian working class should resist potential Slavic revolutions in order to defend their own economic and political interests. Okay, to turn from the Austro-Marxist to the Bund. Bauer's position of personal cultural autonomy was taken up, at least in part, by various socialist groups within the Tsarist Empire, such as the Polish Socialist Party and the Jewish Bund. And the Bund, like the Austrian Social Democrats, were for a federal party. And even Rosa Luxemburg adopted elements of Bauer's position on personal cultural autonomy. I've only time today to deal with Vladimir Metem, the leading Bund theorist on the national question. Metem argued that all citizens belonging to a given national group would join a special organisation that would hold cultural assemblies in each region and have a general cultural assembly for the whole country. The assemblies would be given financial powers of their own. Each national group would be entitled to raise taxes on its members, or the state would allocate a proportion of the budget to each of them. Every citizen of the state would belong to one or other national groups. But the question of which national movement they join would be a matter of personal choice, and no authority would have control over that decision. The national movements would be subject to the broad legislation of the state, but in their own areas of responsibility, they would be autonomous, and none of them would have the right to interfere in the affairs of other national groupings. Now, as with Bauer's approach, I would argue there's a whole series of problems with Metem's alternative. Firstly, under Metem's schema, all nations are seen as being equal. No difference is made or drawn between oppressed and oppressor nations. Secondly, Metem's position is pretty vague on the question of how much autonomy is granted to the national groups. And if we're talking about genuine, wide-ranging autonomy, this schema is obviously totally utopian under capitalism. As though any oppressor nation is going to grant such a degree of autonomy to a nation it oppresses. As though the Israelis will grant such a degree of autonomy to the Palestinians, or the Russians to the Chechens, or China to the Tibetans, or Spain to the Basques. And alternatively, in a worker state or a socialist society, why on earth would you want to permanently cement national divisions in this way? It assumes national divisions are eternal and natural. Thirdly, the approach is totally anti-democratic in that it forces people into a national identity. What about somebody in Turkey who has one parent who's Turkish and one person is Kurdish? Why should they be forced to identify with one national group or another? As Nigel Harris writes, to oblige them to belong to a national grouping was likely to imprison them in an identity from which they wanted to escape as much as liberate them. It was to block the normal process of assimilation. Fourthly, the whole logic of the approach is to divide and fragment the working class movement into separate socialist parties, unions and so on, based on nationality. So in India, you would have separate socialist parties and separate trade unions for the Tamil speakers, for the Bengali speakers, for the Punjabis, for the Gujaratis, and so on. As for Lenin, in direct opposition to both the Austro-Marxists and the Bund, Lenin was for combating nationalism. He correctly understood that nations and nationalism were the relatively recent creation of the bourgeois order. While Bauer argued that socialism would not only preserve national identity but would strengthen it and develop it, Lenin fought for the creation of a socialist society in which national divisions were swept away. Lenin opposed national culture as bourgeois nationalism and advocated for a consistently democratic and socialist internationalist culture. He defended the language rights of oppressed national groups, but was not for the state propping up and cementing artificially created national differences. He was not for pandering to national prejudices. Lenin opposed separate trade unions for each national group within a specific nation and opposed the Bund's demand for to be the sole representative of Jewish workers within inside the Russian Empire. He was a centralised revolutionary party, not a party that was a federation of distinct national groupings. Nonetheless, Lenin drew a sharp distinction between the nationalism of an oppressor nation and the nationalism of an oppressed nation. It was vital in Lenin's view to fight the national chauvinism of the oppressor nation. And if there was to be any hope of unity between the working class of the nation, that was a vital task in their struggle to overthrow the bourgeois order. Concretely for Lenin, that meant supporting the right of national self-determination for oppressed nation, i.e. the right for them to separate and form their own nation states. He was not for fudging the issue with talk about personal cultural autonomy. Only by granting the right of oppressed nations to separate would socialists be in a strong position to argue for unity of workers across the national lines. Lenin's approach served to preserve internationalism as a core element of Marxism, while at the same time recognising that the revolts of oppressed nations could weaken the whole of imperialism and open the road for the struggle for workers' power. And I'll leave it there.